Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
It's all about the macro productions.
Flashback Fridays here on Macro Aggressions, taking you back to December 16th, 2023, moving at warp speed towards liberty with Guard Goldsmith. If you want to turn some of your soon-to-be worthless fiat currency into actual money, then check out my friend Tony Arterburn with Wise Wolf Gold and Silver. Set up a monthly buy with Wolfpack subscription as low as $50, or roll over your IRA and 401k into physical precious metals. You can even use your Bitcoin to make purchases. Go to macroaggressions.gold, promo code macro for some free silver. Now, please enjoy the show.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a prison!
Swangled in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macro aggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin, Rumble, or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate your support. You can follow me on Twitter at Macro Aggressions, or you can find my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Big thank you to our sponsors that make this show happen. Chemical Free Body has been with us since the very beginning. You can check out their detox bundle. I'm on it right now. It's a 90-day plan, getting myself ready for an Acapulco. It worked out perfectly. I started it about 90 days before the Acapulco show. So we'll be ready to rock. If you're interested, chemicalfreebody.com is the place to go. You can use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money. And grab some Green 85, a couple of the detox bundle, and get yourself started. I mean, you change the oil in your car, right? You want to clean out the what's going on in your body as well, right? It makes sense to me. So take a look, chemicalfreebody.com, promo code MACRO. Also, thanks to everybody over at C60 Purple Power. You can check out their website, shopc60.com, and find out what the carbon-60 molecule is. It's such an important invention that the scientists won a Nobel Prize for it. I mean, it's a big deal. They theorized about it in the 60s. Buckminster Fuller did. They discovered it in the late 80s, and the team of scientists won the Nobel Prize. Not the Nobel Prize is good for much of anything. They didn't even have to bomb small third world countries into submission to win the prize too. It's amazing. But you go to Shop C60, you'll find out it's the most powerful antioxidant known to man. It really is. It's hundreds of times more powerful than anything else. It will help your cells be more efficient, maximize the cellular horsepower that you've got. So it's worth taking a look. Go to Shop C60. If you've never heard of it, just go read up about it, see what you think. If you find something that you like, promo code is MACRO. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. And we say that because we have to say that. But you can go to shopc60.com and take a look for yourself. Also, catch you in Mexico in February and Acapulco, February 11th through the 16th. Acapulco, Mexico. You'll love it. It's 5 days of a ton of information, really great people, amazing food, concerts at night, comedy shows going on. I'll be the host and MC of it this year. I'd love to have you all come. It would be a real treat to have the Macroaggressions audience out there as much as possible. So go to anarchapulco.com and promo code MACRO will save you some money. All the links for this are in the description. Well, all right, let's get down to business, shall we? My guest is a novelist and lecturer in economics and political philosophy, a dedicated voluntarist who previously worked in television screenwriting for the series Star Trek Voyager and The Outer Limits, now hosts the weeknight program Liberty Conspiracy on Rumble, Rockfin. Subscribe to his Substack, will you, for God's sake? Ladies and gentlemen, my friend, Gard Goldsmith. Hey, Gard, how are you?
I'm doing great, for God's sake.
I'm already laughing. Every time I see you, make me smile. Every time I see you, and it's not just because we share the same hairstyle, but because we share the same view on the world. And you have been doing this for a very long time. But before we start, I want to. It's very rare that I get a chance to talk to somebody that has actually worked in Hollywood as a screenwriter. I'm interested. Yeah. I wonder how is this. How does screenwriting for Star Trek Voyager and then trying to, you know, deal with the, you know, the dragging your libertarian ideology, did it find its way into the writing? I mean, it kind of had to, right? I mean, in some ways, you're thinking of like a Star Trek future. You're like, well, in a Star Trek future, they'd all be libertarians, right? Of course they would, right?
Boy, you hit, there are two things. You hit two prongs that are so key. It's very interesting, too, because I think as a lot of pro-freedom people, especially people who might have looked back and seen false flags to think about conspiracy things, and then you hear things about Operation Mockingbird and stuff, and you say, oh, you know, that guy came from Hollywood. Either he's on their side or he can tell us about seeing some of the stuff that they were doing there. And that gets into, you know, the whole idea of predictive programming and things like that. So there are a couple things that pop up. The first one was I knew as a libertarian, I was entering the lion's den big time. And at that time, they weren't quite as open about things. You know, you had heard Clint Eastwood mention the word libertarian a little bit, even though he's more sort of a conservative Republican, maybe a libertarian on a small government scale, you know, that sort of thing. Decentralization, that sort of stuff. And then we had heard rumors about Drew Carey being a libertarian and all these things. So one of the things that I thought I might try was to introduce some names. So in various scripts, I started at the Outer Limits in Vancouver, and there you know, it's a Hollywood byproduct. It was a Canadian LA mixture production. And it was very interesting. I got to meet Joe Stefano, who actually started the original Outer Limits, and he was the scriptwriter for Psycho, which is wild. And yeah, he was this little Italian dude, looked like his nose had been broken a bunch of times in street brawls. And somebody was like, hey, Gard, you want to meet Joe? Because he was there because he had started the original series. This is the new group of producers, but he was still part, sort of invested in it or something. And they're like, yeah, he's up visiting from L.A. You want to meet him? I'm like, sure. So I'm shaking his hand. They're like, yeah, you know, he's co-creator of the original series. And, you know, he wrote Psycho. But while I'm shaking his hand, I'm like, dude, you wrote the script for Psycho based on the Robert Bloch book? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, oh man, that's an achievement. It's good stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So you meet these different people and stuff, and then you're trying to work on your scripts. And script writing is, I mentioned this when I was streaming the other day, script writing actually for me is not that hard compared to like prose writing, where you got to have the style, the rhythm, you know, you're trying to really do something with the words. And for me, it's, you know, it's dialogue, it's plot, you got settings and the rest of it, you know. So I would try to sneak words, names in like Rothbard, like Murray Rothbard's name.
I knew you were going to say that for some reason. I just knew you were going to say Rothbard above it.
Yeah.
How can I make this guy sound, you know, like, you know, I can drag this name.
That's exactly. I have, there's one script where this girl's dog is called Rothbard. And I found out, I think it was recently, that dude Millet from Argentina, I guess he has a dog named Rothbard. Like, perfect. Dude, I like you. You're all right, man. So that was interesting. And then when I went to Star Trek, you nailed it, Charlie, because Star Trek, the creation of Gene Roddenberry, is a total one world socialist utopia that would never work. It would never, right. ever work. And I'll give you an example. So, you know, he's got the UN leaves with the United Federation of Planets. And I can understand how guys who came out of World War II got rooked into, you know, many of them into thinking that if they could just stop having nation states, they wouldn't have these international conflicts like they just suffered through World War II. Rod Serling was the same way. He did a film for the UN, promoting the UN in the 60s. He wrote this script about the UN and how it was stopping war. And I'm like, well, if you could only see what's happened, you know, that sort of thing. And so Gene Roddenberry was the same way, you know, and who knows how much influence he had from other figures, you know, if there were like CIA people helping to push him and promote him, who knows, right? So I go there, I'm a libertarian. And by that time, that was in Hollywood. And, you know, they're on Melrose Ave and stuff like that at the Paramount Studios. So that I was very, very careful there. Like, I, you know, I didn't get into political conversations with people the first couple of weeks. I was like, I got to find out who's going to explode at me here. And so it turned out that one day I was there and Brandon Braga, who created the Borg, which is really, and I spoke to him later, like, that's really was inspired by the Cybermen from Doctor Who. He's like, yeah, yeah, of course. This is essentially the Cybermen. And one day I had a Reason Magazine t-shirt on under my button-down shirt, and I was like the low guy on the totem pole. So we're in a story meeting, all the writers are there, and it's what's called a break session, where they'll buy an idea from an outside writer. And, you know, at that time, I think it was like $6,000 for a plot idea. And those writers would come in late afternoon and pitch to various staff writers. They'd come in and if the staff writer liked it, they would say, okay, let me take this idea down, see if the producer will buy it. If we buy it, then the writer, the outside writer, would get $6,000 for the idea. They give up the rights to the idea. And then we would take it and expand it into a 5-act story, you know, hour long story. So I was the low guy and I would be up at the board during the break sessions. We'd all be there. And so I would write all the different acts and scenes down and all the different sort of emotional points that we wanted to hit. And then I would dictate that to the secretary, and then she would hand it to the writer who got assigned to write that script that week. And then either the next week or the week after, they would, you know, hire a director and they'd shoot the story. So it was a really cool process to watch, you know, from inception all the way through to final production meetings, going down on set, seeing Seven of Nine and that incredible leotard. That was easy. And she was great. Jerry Ryan was super nice woman. And to think that she was married to the dude who got knocked out and Barack Obama took that Senate seat. She was married to that guy, Mark Ryan. And in their divorce, it got exposed that he wanted her to go to like sex parties or something like that. And that's what brought him down. He was going to be the Republican candidate and Obama got in instead. So she was super nice. And she always had a lot of guards around her when she would leave the studios and stuff like that, because, you know, she was in these sort of revealing outfits and everything. I was like, oh, geez, poor woman, you know, but she was nice, really, really cool. So one day I had the Reason Magazine shirt on and I'm up at the board and one of the writers sort of almost derisive was like, what's that under your shirt? And I remember Brandon Braga, and I had dinner with him a few years ago. I went back over and we had dinner, and he said, hey, I've been looking at your stuff. You're a libertarian. And I was like, yeah, you are too. He goes, how'd you know I'm a libertarian? I was like, cause there was that one day when I had the Reason Magazine shirt on and so-and-so said, what's that shirt? And you spoke up. You said, oh, it's Reason Magazine. It's a libertarian magazine. I was like, only somebody who knows the Reason Magazine at that time you'd have to be a libertarian. He goes, ah, you got me. You got me. So it was pretty cool. And the other little bit about it was when you talk about like Star Trek in, you know, Hollywood science fiction, script writing, stuff like that, you try to inject these ideas and you end up running into sometimes, in this case, it was a structural problem. I had an idea for a story and I said, I go to pitch it to Jerry Taylor, who's the executive producer. She had worked on Quincy and all these different shows. Really nice woman. And I said, Jerry, I've got this idea. It's sort of a sting. It's a lot of comedy. The Voyager crew needs to get some money. So they have to pull a sting to get some money. And they have, you know, they work on these bad guys and stuff like that. And she goes, oh, I got to stop you there, Gard. I was like, why? She goes, well, before he died, Gene stipulated in his will or something that there would be no money in the Federation. I was like, no money. She's like, yeah. And I was like, you understand that that's not possible. People want to get, they want to get paid for what they're doing. They need a currency to be able to transact. She goes, I know. You have no idea the headaches. And I was like, so what do you do? Resort to barter? She's like, and I was like, this is the 23rd century spacefaring and you're bartering? She goes, I know, Gard, it's just ridiculous. So I ended up writing an article about it for the Foundation for Economic Education and about how stupid Star Trek was, that they actually don't pay the people on their ships. And
are they indentured slaves on the ship?
I know.
Is that what we've decided? Star Trek is running a slave colony on Mars?
Yeah, exactly. It was so, so dumb. And I will say, And again, I hate to have to bring it up it for some people, but, you know, Operation Warp Drive or whatever that was, warp speed that Trump came up with. Well, my name is not, it's not recognized in any ways, but I'll let you know. And I think I mentioned this to David Knight. I'm the guy who saved warp drive on Star Trek Voyager for the whole Star Trek franchise, because there was an episode during the, I don't remember what season it was, but, you know, the premise for Star Trek Voyager was that they were very far away in this distant quadrant. They got teleported there and they were trying to make it back to the Federation quadrants. They were lost in space, essentially. And as they came back, they would have these adventures and people that they encountered and all this stuff. Well, they wanted to speed things up. And even at warp 9, based on the distance, if anybody did the math, it would have taken them years to get back. So they're like, we need a new system of propulsion. So they called it slipstream drive, and they get it from some alien. Now, I had only been there for like a week. And so I was totally like low man. I was what they call the Writers Guild fellow. My salary was actually paid by the Writers Guild. And so I knew, I was hearing all these people like, yeah, so we'll do this new drive. It'll go even faster. It'll be called slipstream drive. I was like, oh, so that's like an update for all the Star Trek shows and the movies that might come. They won't use warp now. That'll be slipstream drive. Like that, like, isn't warp sort of like, you know, like beam me up. It's like a tagline, you know, warp 10, warp 9. And we can see it was, because, I mean, friggin', you know, Donald Trump used warp. You know, it was. Yeah. Oh, it was a catchy, very, very catchy thing.
I'm surprised they didn't get rid of it after that, after he used
it. I know. Exactly. Right. So maybe they were sponsored by Pfizer. Star Trek brought to you by Pfizer, Operation Warp Speed. But it was very interesting because I didn't know what to say in the meeting. And I'm hearing this and it's just unraveling. They're really gluing themselves to this idea. And I know that either they're going to have to resolve it later, or if they don't and they put it in this show, they're going to have major problems with the higher ups later on. Like this, they can't do this. If this gets into a script, this is really bad. This is a bomb that's going to go off. And it might sound kind of stupid, but at the time it was pretty important for the Star Trek franchise. Like, you can't get rid of warp drive. This is a big deal, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's like the communicator teleporter. You got to have it. So I didn't know what to say. Cause if I said problem, you guys, there's a problem. I was very nervous about it. So I was silent throughout the whole meeting. I was like, okay, well, that's a good idea. That's cool. And then at the end, I waited for Brannon, and everybody else is filing out. And I hung out in the hallway outside, and there's little elevators, tiny little elevator that brought us upstairs to like where Deep Space Nine did their stuff and everything. And, or you could go up the stairs, but I always went up the stairs. So instead of going up the stairs, I just waited, and Brannon comes out. I was like, hey, Brannon. That was a good meeting. He goes, yeah, oh yeah, you like the meeting? I was like, yeah, that was cool. I was like, oh, quick question, Brandon, on this slipstream drive. He goes, yeah, yeah. I was like, and I knew that at that time, if I phrased something as a question, it wouldn't be me bringing up the problem. Like, you can't do that, you know? I just would get them to think, to realize, oh, we can't do that. So I was like the neophyte, you know, who didn't understand and stuff. I was the naive guy, you know. I was like, yeah, that's kind of cool. So that'll speed things up. We can, you know, get to the regular Federation space sooner. He's like, yeah. I was like, does that mean that when they, you know, they get back that, you know, they won't have warp drive anymore for Federation and Star Trek? And he's like, oh, we got to fix that. I'm like, oh, cool. So they got rid of it. They got rid of this, you know, maybe it doesn't seem significant for some people, but it was, you know, for me, I'm like, okay, I saved warp drive. That's cool.
Well, it reminds me of hearing the story of Return of the Jedi when it was about to come out, and that how they were doing like a test screening for a bunch of people, and they played the movie, and this kid apparently afterwards said, the movie was named differently. It was Revenge of the Jedi.
Revenge.
And the kids said,
I have a poster with Revenge on it. It must be
it's going to be worth something, because somebody questioned him and said, Jedi would never seek revenge. And they went, you're right. We have to change it. So then it became Return of the Jedi. And apparently that was like a last minute decision. So last minute, in fact, that there were posters printed that said Revenge of the Jedi, which you have, of course.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, sometimes you gotta bring in the new guy who's not so close to it, who can maybe see something that that the rest of the people can't see. Bring in a kid who says this is incompatible with this whole philosophy of the Jedi, or if these guys get back and they've got new technology that the other people didn't have, like, now what?
And isn't it funny how people have such, they either have normalcy bias or they have resistance, you know, and like, you know, like the Emperor's New Clothes, you know, and we can apply this in so many ways in politics or whatever it is. You get people who get so ticked off when you just like bring up something that shakes them around a little bit. And I guess, you know, everybody is like that, I suppose, for different things. But that it is pretty interesting when you see that sort of stuff. And I remember I've had situations where I've been in political. I'll give you an example. There was a woman. I used to get invited to a high school, and they had this thing called a political speedometer thing, and they would have like a conservative Republican, a so-called moderate Republican who was really a Democrat. And they would have a liberal Democrat, and then my friend Mike, who was the history teacher, who was more libertarian, he would have me come in, and I always made sure I sat at the end. After a while he picked up on it and he realized, but I would be the guy who would answer, you know, they'd pose a question, the kids would ask a question. They'd always go in the same order. So I got to act cleanup at the end of it. I got to hear everything else that everybody was saying. We're like, well, so-and-so said this, that's factually incorrect. You know, let me tell you what's going on with so-called climate change. Read this book, or yeah, you might want to check this website. So anyway, so that was a lot of fun. And I had an experience where, so I got invited to another high school to do a similar thing. In this case, it was for candidates. And I was the Libertarian Senate candidate, but I told people I wouldn't accept the office because I'm an anarchist. I was just running because I wanted to be able to get into the debates. And I was like, but if, you know, you vote, it was a weird thing. So anyway, I got up there and there weren't other candidates for that office. There were just a bunch of like people running for, you know, local council or the state house or whatever. But it was to give kids an idea of, you know, people running for office. So I get up there and I was talking about how then Governor Jean Shaheen lied and gave false information. And I was like, you know, and then I continued to call this office to say, what is the real information? And then they kept delaying. And I was like, I had a study that had been released 30 days before that had counter information. And I was like, yeah, she just bald-facedly lied to me in the governor's office in front of all these reporters. And I was like, and if you want information on it, this reporter was there, that reporter was there, you can check them out. I went into the climate change stuff. It's like, get Fred Singer's book, Unstoppable Global Warming, every 1500 years. It's about solar cycles. I talked about Al Gore's Michael Mann graph that, you know, you and I discussed. And I went through, I was like, you know, and I even said to the students, I was like, look, you don't even have to remember my name, but if I can, you know, inspire you to look up some libertarian stuff, go to Foundation for Economic Education. You get great stuff on, you know, Mises Institute, Independent Institute, you know, look up Lou Rockwell. Just check this stuff out. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter if you think about me, but if you get the information and you think it's worthwhile, you know, I've had a good time with you. Thanks a lot. And we had, you know, the other people who were there at the end of this thing, they, at the doors were up at the top of the little auditorium. We were down in a little basin. They made a semicircle in front of the doors and they wouldn't let me leave. They were so angry. I thought they were going to attack me, like come to physical blows. They're like,
wow,
you called Gene, you criticized Gene Shaheen, you know? And I was like, no, I overtly said she's a liar and she can sue me if she wants to. Because I've got the information. And if you listen to the information and you paid attention and you didn't just care about the personality in whom you've got so much invested, you would see that I could dissect her like a pith frog. I was like, I could destroy her in a debate any second. So if you want to debate it, let's go ahead. And right. Then they like, and you questioned climate change. I was like, I offered them information. I was like, what did you do? And that got them to shut up. You know,
yeah,
it's
a very weird thing. We get attached to these politicians, we get attached to these ideas, and then we just not we, but I mean the general public will they won't see the flaws. They see somebody and they like so many aspects of them, and then but they can't see the underside of them. And you go, oh, I like this guy. He's saying all the right things. And Tulsi Gabbard. Prime example.
Yeah,
right. Tulsi Gabbard comes on, right? She's talking anti-war. She was in the military. Well, she would know, right? You got to be anti-war. And she talks a good game and she looks good and she surfs and you like her. And she goes on Rogan and she's making a lot of sense. And then people go, I like Tulsi. And then you go, but what about the World Economic Forum, young global leader? And you go, well, and you know, and so people start to make excuses like, well, what about the fact that she's in the psychological warfare division of her army branch? It's like, it's like we have to be intellectually honest, right? We have to recognize if the person that you like is secretly doing some things that aren't ethical or puts them in a covert globalist camp, like a World Economic Forum young global leader, you have to call them out on it, like Derek Bros did when Derek Bros followed her out after and asked her and her press secretary a question. It was walking them out to the parking lot and they stopped and answered the question. And then he said, you know, what about you, your admission as a World Economic Forum young global leader? You know,
right,
what do you have to say about that? And the press secretary said the interview's over and they just walked away. And so it's like, you can't just pretend like those things aren't there because they're important, right? We have to be honest about this. So defending these candidates, well, defend the candidate if you want, as long as the candidate is defendable. But as soon as they start to pivot to the dark side or do these sort of things, like you have to mention that as well, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, Charlie, because you get me thinking about, you know, what Derek did. And I've grown a lot, even at that time, like when I talked about dissector, like pith frog, I didn't say that, actually. It was in my mind. At that time, I was starting to sift through the more confrontational things that I might say and the sort of, you know, attract more bees with honey sort of approach. And it's really more my emotional, just my general psychology anyway, not to be like super attack confrontational kind of guy. And that's what I love so much about guys like you and Derek and other people, where, you know, it's not that you want to be Machiavellian in any way. It's just that I've just noted that, you know, there are two things. One, it's really not my nature to be like super attack confrontational unless it's a really bad person. Then you set them up in some chess piece moves and then you bring them down pretty easily or whatever. But with somebody like that you really hope, like, hey, I want to give that person a chance. You know, I'm doing commentary. I'm looking at all this stuff. There's lots of people I have to talk about and they can't, you know, many of them don't even know I'm talking about them. But if they do know, I'd like to offer them the opportunity to maybe straighten this out, you know, because I admire that person. It's the same thing. And Tulsi's a perfect example where Tulsi, I always had a problem where you say, well, look, you're anti-war, but you're in the military and you're voting for the NDAA every time. And you know that you swear an oath to the Constitution. I'm an anarchist, as you know, but at least on your game with the Constitution, you could be, there's a disconnect here. You know, it's very clear there's no declaration of war. So what you are doing here, can we talk about how you rationalize this? And I think that that approach and then seeing the closed door, even there, you could say, okay, give her one more chance. Maybe we get, you know, talk to Tulsi, say, you know, your press secretary person, we really would love to talk to you about this openly. Would you talk about this? Maybe that was a little disconnect that we had here. Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of people on the left wing side, when they hear about Bernie Sanders, they over the recent years, they started to see he's a major, major, massive hypocrite. And and his anti-war rhetoric is just, you know, full of marshmallow fluff. You know, this is a guy who supposedly stood for peace and yet had his honeymoon in Soviet Russia. Anybody at that time knew that that place was a den of evil murderers. You know, why would you ever possibly want to go there? Everybody knew what Castro was like. You know, it's like you don't go praising these people. You can say, hey, the United States has done things in opposition to these. What are the forces behind this? But you don't go praising Stalin, for God's sake. You know, like FDR's team, three quarters of his team, they were applauding Stalin. They knew he was a mass murderer and he had an eyeball collection. Like they knew what he was like. You know, we were talking beforehand. Today's Pearl Harbor Day. And, you know, my dad realized decades later what an evil scumbag. He already didn't like FDR's policies and thought he was a liar. But on Pearl Harbor itself, you know, some of his best friends were killed. And one of his buddies was killed in the Ploister oil raids. Never saw him again. You know, as I mentioned to you, my in the audience will not know this, but, you know, my uncle was in World War II with Patton and he was run over by a tank. But luckily, the ground was so squishy, he got up and it just pushed him in the mud. These sacrifices that these people went through, you know, some of these people, they deserve, you know, our umbrage. But on the some of these people like Bernie Sanders, you say, OK, I know a lot of people really like Bernie. So is there a way that I'll hold back my umbrage just for a second, just to get some regular questions out there? So say to these people, look, I just would like to engender you to look again at Bernie Sanders and say, okay, why is it that Bernie Sanders got Lockheed Martin to open a plant in Vermont if he's so pro-peace, right? Why is it that every time he speaks out against the United States, every year he still votes for the National Defense Authorization Act to fund those guys who are over in those other countries? If he's consistent, he would oppose that. If he's really for peace, he would become an anarchist and stop saying, I'm going to force my neighbor to pay for anything, because that's the baseline. That's the moral predicate upon which everything else unravels. If you're willing to say, I am in a position of so-called authority and I'm going to vote to steer this ship, then what you're doing is you're chaining people to that ship and you got to stop.
Yeah. So. And he's been a great example of just government hypocrisy. It's like, you want to like him when he talks a good game. And then you see him, you know, I'll tell you when he said, you know, we've got to, after he got knocked out of the race and Hillary sort of took over, when he said, we've got to get behind Hillary. I've made the point that the only way in which you make that statement is if Hillary Clinton is standing backstage with a gun to your kid's head. That's the only way you make that. That is a hostage statement, you know, and for, oh, I want to play, you want to play nice with, I mean, I get it. You don't want to blow up in an airplane. But to go out there and say that to your people that have worked their ass off for nothing, grassroots campaign, knocked on doors, printed flyers, put in emotional energy, physical energy, invested their time and effort to try and make you the president. And then you go out and tell them that they have to go and vote for Hillary fucking Clinton. Are you out of your mind? That should have been the end of the road for him. He should have been laughed off of any stage he ever got on. But people just forget or something. They want to believe, oh, well, there must have been something more to it. Well, maybe there was something more to it. But you walk out on that stage and you say, Hillary Clinton stole this from me. and all you people need to know it, and don't ever vote for her. She's an evil son of a bitch, and walk off the stage. That's the way the presentation goes. If you want to have any sort of self-respect, or you want to honor the people that have invested so much into your campaign and got behind you and really believed in you and you lied. I mean, I get it. Like, the DNC is corrupt as hell, but still, what he did, I thought was so disrespectful to the people that had tried to help him get elected. And I know, I mean, listen, I mean, the machine works a certain way, and he probably never really honestly had a chance. But there's a lot of his followers thought that he did, and they believed him, and they thought, this guy might be different. This guy sees the world a little bit differently. Well, guess what? When you get into those levels of American politics, whether you're Bernie Sanders or you're RFK Jr., you know, eventually you talk and talk and talk. And then people start to realize, you are not what I thought you were. And RFK Jr. to me has been that. You know, he came out and he's anti-vaccine. He kind of tried to ride the line on that one and say, well, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro testing of vaccines and science. Okay, you're anti-vaccine. I get it. So am I. It's fine. Just come out of the closet already. But then saying, like, oh, well, you know, we have to stand fully behind Israel and do everything that they say. You just throw your hands up and you go, it's just another one. Here we go again. Another one of these guys I really want to like, but I just can't. The minute they talk about foreign policy, I just go, nope, automatic disqualification. You're out.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very interesting because culturally, Charlie, I noticed I'm a Gen X guy, and I noticed that it seemed like a lot of people who were in my generation really looked at those so-called peace baby boomer type people and said, nah, I think there's a lot of inconsistency here, because you supposedly are pro-peace, and yet you want to tax people. You're in favor of massive regulations. You're in favor of this, of that. You say you want honest representation in government, and yet that constitution you've got there doesn't allow a lot of these things. Where are you getting this stuff on, you know, funding our school and trying to manipulate our school on a local level? Where's that coming from? So there were all these inconsistencies that were flags that would go off, not false flags. There were flags that would unravel. For a lot of us, we're stuck in that, you know, 12-year sentence of the government-run school system, where we saw the massive hypocrisy, these baby boomers up in front of the class teaching us. I mean, I've mentioned this before. I had baby boomer teachers. One of them threw me in a closet, and it was ridiculous. I wasn't doing anything. The other one would consistently pull my hair and almost poured a soda over my head just because I was telling her that FDR's economic ideas were ridiculous. They were unconstitutional, that the Works Progress Association was socialistic, that it was, you know, backwards and paying people to kill pork, you know, all this other stuff, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, all these things, right? And, you know, I was like 15. I was like, how do I know more about this than you do? This is ridiculous. My parents are forced to pay you. There's a systemic problem there. And they would not question those things. So I saw paradigmatically how those people were very much in favor. I drilled down into it by the time I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. I was like, oh, there's a problem with what is behind this, the state. The state is behind this. They want their hands on the state. And we saw it. We saw what happened when they got their hands on the state. Friggin', you know, bombing of Serbia. You know, the blockade of Iraq, as you know, that classic and is sadly classic Madeleine Albright conversation on 60 Minutes. And that was only halfway there, as we saw with, you know, these people talking about Osama bin Laden. There was another 500,000 probably killed after Madeleine Albright was on 60 Minutes in 1996. So, you know, all these types of things that pop up and you say, OK, I can understand the final point here. I can understand how some people would be opposed to so-called corporatism, right? Because corporations are creations of the government, and they think, okay, there's the David Goliath thing, and there's this weird, sometimes balance, sometimes imbalance with some of the sentiment that Karl Marx expressed at the end of the old royal period and the onset of the Industrial Revolution, which was, he was able to replace the umbrage that a lot of the locals had after the enclosure movement in England in particular, that they disliked the old feudal system. They didn't want to be the serfs anymore. And he was able to change that hatred, that anger, resentment, and move it on to the new business people. In some cases, the criticism is correct. If you look at the special favors, the corporatism, the mercantilism, as Adam Smith would describe it, of those people who were sort of in the last lines of the royal peerage system, who then gamed Parliament literally to get what they called special acts of Parliament for one person to be able to take land in the enclosure movement. And if you look at Thomas More's Utopia, that's a great example. It opens up with a conversation about sheep. And part of the reason was that was a criticism about how this peerage system in the last days, for many years after the French came in, the Roundheads came in, they would take what was formerly the commoner's land, and it would be taken over by these people connected to the bloodlines. And instead of having crops there, these people realized they could make a lot of money. They would move sheep in. So Thomas More's Utopia opens up talking about sheep. And you can see it in Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, Volume 1. He talks about how the sheep wool industry became very, very big in England in the 15, 1600s as they started to get into colonialism. And part of the reason for that was because they had this enclosure movement that was tied to the royals. So Marx's criticism, if he had just understood that nexus or expressed it better, and of course his economics was all screwed up too because he thought valuation came from how much work you put into something, but that wasn't just his mistake. A lot of people made that mistake. It's valuation is based on whether or not a consumer is going to buy it. If I don't think it's worth anything, it doesn't matter how much work you put into it, you know?
Right.
So as Mises explained, and so many of the Austrians did. So, you know, you can understand sentimentally or culturally how people would buy into a Bernie Sanders sentiment where it's like, well, look, if we've got these corporations, we're going to fight the corporations. So you can even see how that leads to a destination of Liz Warren's. We got to have the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. We got to have Frank Dodd. We got to have all these things to fight the corporations. We got to fight the corporations. You create the corporations. You are the entity. You are the giant corporation, the state that creates the corporations. And it's just like RFK Jr. If you read RFK Jr.'s opening of The Real Anthony Fauci, just in the opening, he talks about, he doesn't question the unconstitutionality or the constitutionality of the FDA. Doesn't talk about that. He just says during the 80s, the Reagan administration didn't fund the FDA enough. So it got the system got gamed. The system was gamed decades before that. Mary Ruart has a great book called Death by Regulation. And she goes back to the 60s. She shows how the corporations, because there was this new entity created called the FDA, they were incentivized to influence the FDA, to help them. Mercantilism, just like when you get the end of the old royal peerage system and the start of the Industrial Revolution, Marx's criticism against the industrialists sounds really good. But what he's not attacking is the royal peerage system that could help those specific guys. And the very thing that was breaking down the royal peerage system was competitive free markets. So they want to destroy competitive free markets. They blame competitive free markets for the problems. And they're not talking about what really is the problem, which is the state and its ability to be able to give competitors in the free market the ability to disconnect from competing and getting the government to give them the benefits.
You must have been apoplectic when during COVID, the government shut down the small and medium-sized businesses, but magically left Home Depot open. You know what I mean? Bob's Lumber down the street was closed because, you know, we could spread COVID, but Home Depot was open and you go, how does this make any sense? This is like a new weird form of state-controlled monopoly where they can say, you and you are all closed and you can go out of business if you want. Maybe we'll give you a loan. Maybe we won't. I don't know. But all these other companies that may or may not have donated to political campaigns, they are allowed to exist. And then, of course, you see what happens there. The main street goes out of business. You know, the small mom and pop stores go under. Mistakes were made. And then they paper over this whole thing. And just, you know, after a couple, you know, a year or so, and they say, well, you know, now everyone can go. We can go back to normal. Normal? What?
I know.
It's not normal for those people. Those people are out of business now. Their new normal is I don't have a job. I don't have a company because Walmart took all my business, or it all moved online. And this was allowed to happen. I mean, they were allowed to deliver boxes to my door, right? How did you view that whole thing? You must have been.
Your point, your line about going back to normal, Charlie, that's the thing. Because the foundational problems here, the normalcy biases, the going back to normal is the state already having established these mechanisms of control. So in addition to the umbrage that people should have felt and gotten them in revolution when the state was saying, your job is essential, your job is non-essential, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. There are two levels on which I would operate here, just to remind people. So constitutionally, obviously, none of that stuff, none of it is acceptable. It is all insulting, spit in your face, and how many people are going to buy into this stuff while you sit there and you're quiet? Speak up, for God's sake. At least say something is wrong. And I'll give you an example. So there's a clause in the Constitution called the Contract Clause, and that prohibits any state from interfering in the fulfillment of an already agreed to private contract. Any state interference in a private contract that says, well, you got to wear a mask or you can't go to work. You got to wear a mask. You got to have people wear a mask or you can't let them into your business. Sorry, that's not in our stinking contract. You don't have the power to tell us how we're going to voluntarily interact with one another. That's freedom of association, for God's sake. Get out of here. And it's because people don't want to come to that final position, or they give people this narrative that supports the oppression. Well, if you don't support this oppression, if you don't support enslaving the people on the plantation, then everyone will get sick. It's like, no, guess what? We're free individuals. You don't have the right to do this. There's no such thing as so-called public health. There's individual health. What you're doing is you're sacrificing the individual for what you're arguing is the better public outcome. That's consequentialism. That's immoral. That is how mass extermination happens. That's why Mao, that's the excuse he gave for putting professors out in the fields and killing the farm owners. That's how the Kulak thing started in Ukraine. You don't do that. You know, anybody who's read The Long Walk, the story about those guys who were put into Siberia and during Stalin's heyday, and they walked thousands of miles all the way to India. A couple of them didn't make it. But the opening of that thing is such a stark description of exactly the physical ardors that those people went through on the trains. They were literally freezing to death in the boxcars as they were going from 1,700 miles on a train. And they had no heat. It was just their barely clothed bodies inside these boxcars. They would take turns moving around the boxcars so some guys could move to the center of the group inside the center of the boxcar because the exteriors were so cold. So they would circle around. He said, and sometimes guys would die on their feet. They were so packed. And he's like, you'd be brushing up against a guy. He was cold. He was dead, but he was still on his feet leaning against a wall. That's what they went through. And that is the manifestation of the maximization of exactly the type of thing. That's the mindset that these people tell us when there is a job that's essential, there's a job that's unessential. And the thing that really gets me is you got the Constitution, you got the contract clause, you got all these different types of things, you get the money that they're sending out. You look at the ramifications. They still have established such controls that now, of course, they're blocking Russian oil from coming in. They still have the jab mandate for international truckers. Until people question how another human being can say, I've got the guns and there's this border place and we're going to control, based on a bunch of people who vote, we're going to control how that's going to work, so that you can't get a product that somebody might want to ship in from Toronto, some other person. You could wave hello to him from Detroit, but you can't buy something from him. He can't send something over to you, because we got guys with guns right here. And we're protecting you from your own decisions. And if you make your own decisions, that's dangerous. because that could spread a virus to somebody. Meanwhile, the people who are going to police stopping the virus can invade your house, grab you, pull your mask off, and do anything they want. It's utter madness. And until they question this lattice, this framework, this spider web of, and it's a very solid spider web of regulatory controls and claims of power over trade and all these different types of things. And this is the thing with RFK Jr., to bring it back to him. He's critical of the FDA getting gamed by the rent seekers. It's like, dude, until you question the immorality of saying that someone can or cannot voluntarily buy something, you're out of my book. Yeah. I don't need you. You know, you need to question the morality of these things. That's it. If I never win any political victory, if I never change anything, if I never get any bureaucracy brought down, at least I've stood to question the morality of someone telling his neighbor you can or cannot do something peaceful. That's yeah. all, you know?
Yeah, I wonder about this with the COVID era, if it's going to wake up a new generation of people that feel that that they see now what the state is capable of, and more importantly, they see what their fellow man, you know, their fellow countrymen are capable of in the name of saving them from a virus with a 99.98% survivability yes. rate, you know. And I start to think about that, and I see this. You know, the COVID Karens of the world, call the police if there's too many cars in your neighbor's driveway on Thanksgiving for a super spreader event. And I go, that's bad, of course, and that's crazy, and that's no way that we want to live. But I start to extrapolate out maybe a decade from now and say that's going to be the same thing, but with climate. Right.
Yeah.
Like a climate Karen, like right. somebody that say you were cooking steaks in your backyard at that barbecue. I could smell them. And so I called the police and now they're at your door and they want to talk to you about your red meat consumption. Right.
Yeah. 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 Charlie, boy. And kudos to you, too. You know, I'm only sort of just entering this game after having been I wasn't doing a lot of videos and stuff. I was doing stuff for MRC TV. But that was only a couple videos a week and, you know, like four articles a week or whatever. And so, you know, you're one of the guys that I've always watched and, you know, enjoyed and so on. And yeah, absolutely. You know, it's being able to meet you over the past year or so and talk to you like this has been something that, you know, like I said, when you were down in New York, I was like, oh, I really want to meet Charlie and get my high
likewise.
Five. Oh yeah. Thanks, man. You know, and you're a kindred spirit. You're a brother, dude. I really appreciate it. And, and it's very hopeful. And, you know, we talked in email about sentimentally, you want to keep fighting, but I think there is something really positive that's happening. And I think it's on two levels. One is a sort of kindred spirit, spiritual friendliness, a feeling of finding brotherhood with mm-hmm. other people. And you don't want that to, you know, you don't want it to be a fraud or anything like that. You don't want to be rooked into anything like that. But when you find these people who have brought you so much, and this brings me to, you know, what we discussed last night, I went to go see Andrea Bocelli down at the Boston Garden. I had gotten tickets for my family for Christmas, and it was, you know, it was a really going to be a wonderful thing. We had dinner beforehand, and that was great. And drove down to Boston together, you know, about an hour drive from New Hampshire. And so, you know, we hold on to our wallets because the tax men are trying to reach in everywhere. And so we got there and there was a little delay and stuff. And then a woman came out on the stage. There was nobody on the stage yet. The house lights were still up and everything. And it was his wife, and she was just in jeans and a blouse and she had a piece of paper. And I was like, Oh, I think they're maybe going to have to cancel the show. I wonder what's going on. And sure enough, she's like, yeah, you know, right up until 8 o'clock here, we were really hoping. We went through the rehearsal, the sound check, and, you know, Andrea Bocelli's son is there with him. He's a terrific singer, handsome kid. Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, the girls must go crazy for him. And his daughter, I think she's like 13. Her voice is amazing too. They sing that song, Alleluia, the Leonard Cohen song. They do that together. And boy, is that good. It's great. And his wife is a singer. They're great, you know? So I thought, oh, geez, this is such a shame. And as I mentioned to you, then him being blind, of course, he gets led by people. Most times, you know, he might walk a few feet here and there because he knows an area or whatever, but you could see his hand was on the stairs coming up to the stage. And she says, oh, she turned to the side. She says, oh, yeah. Okay. So she says, he wants to come up and speak to you. So he came up, she took him by the arm or whatever. And he came up and took the microphone and he said, you know, folks, I'm very disappointed. Please keep your tickets. And it was a very strange sort of a thing, because what goes through your mind is, you know, there's this weird mix racing of thoughts racing through your mind of, wow, you know, this is just a family of people. He's blessed with this amazing voice. They come from Italy. They have a beautiful area. He has a vineyard, you know, tradition, history, wonderful, very nice people. He's very religious. And, you just want to wish the best for these people. And then that makes you think of the other people in the audience and what they might be experiencing. And you just want to wish the best for them. And it really grounds you. You don't want to make it like a lesson about yourself, because it's about their stresses and what they're going through. But I thought, I wonder if he's been jabbed. And you know, with all the travel he's had to do, and even though he's very Christian, and, you know, maybe he didn't know that there was, you know, the tie into the fetal stem cell lines and all that stuff. So I don't know, you know. So hopefully it's just a passing thing, and it's just, you know, like a chest cold or something. But, you know, he just said, I don't think I could perform up to the level that you would deserve having come here. And I want to do it right for you. So, you know, we're going to put it off. And I'm sure they've got insurance and there's a lot of stuff, but there's so much involved, you know, the venue and how many t-shirts will they sell, the drinks, the band, the orchestra, the guest that comes in for 20 minutes, you know, how is all that handled? So we went back and I thought about it. And a lot as we were going back, because it gets you so angry, these forces that have rooked so many people, that took our money to develop these viruses, the jabs themselves. And you can go through systemically, you can go through the functional arguments on their constitutional level, that there's nothing in there that gives them the ability to develop virus protection or vaccines or anything like that, unless they do it through the Defense Department, which is what they did, as Sasha Laripova pointed out. But the trick about that is they have to declare war. Otherwise, and this goes towards like old style constitutionalist discussions, but otherwise the members of the militia are supposed to be within their states until they're called up. That's it. It's not that you're developing all these weapons and stuff. You don't have standing armies. They have to amend their constitution. At least they could be honest about it. So that got me thinking about all of that stuff and about all those jobs that have been lost, all those people whose lives have been, you know, destroyed, strokes, nerve problems. And it is a weird, it's sort of an apocalyptic, obviously people have felt this biblical thing where you say, there's something really big going on here, and I can't put my finger on it, but we are in a major, major, very important fight. I could go down at any time, but if I can give somebody a thumbs up as I'm going down, keep going, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that got me when I got home. I heard Ron Paul and Daniel McAdams talking, and that really lifted my spirits, because that's exactly the approach they have. They're like, if I can give somebody a lesson they can take with them about economics and truth, cool. So that's the approach.
Yeah. Well, Ron Paul, I've seen him speak 3 times at Anarchapulco, and he's still fired up and pissed off.
Yeah.
You know, he's still angry about these people. And thank you to Ron Paul, by the way, who has been, you know, intellectually consistent the whole time. He's been a guy that has, he's been the real deal. I don't know if you know this, but I haven't really told too many people, I guess I'd probably say it here on the show, but Ron Paul agreed to write the foreword to the book I wrote with Jeff Berwick, The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. He agreed to write it. And Jeff was like, hey, Dr. Paul's going to write it. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be great. And 2 days after he had agreed to write it, he had that medical incident Right. On camera, on when camera, we had like right. the slight stroke, and we were like, "Oh boy, what do we do?" You know, and we're both like, "We got to let him off the hook on this one." You know what I mean? Like we respect him too much to make him, you know, to have him like in his hospital room. We're like, "Dr. Paul, we need," you know, it was literally the last thing we were waiting for was that. Yeah. You know, that was it. The book is done as soon as we get that, and so that would have been a treat to have. We had Doug Casey instead, and Doug Casey from International Man. He's
awesome.
He's a savage in his own right, of course. But and we love Doug Casey. But to have Dr. Paul be involved in that, and you know, and I watched him at an Arcapulco. I went to the dinner with him, and he did a little, you know, grabbed the microphone and did a little talk at dinner as well. And I just go,
he's amazing.
He is amazing.
He's amazing.
Daniel McAdams was with him too, and
yeah.
And so, and you just, and I think, am I going to be that fired up and pissed off at 80 something? And the answer is, I certainly hope so. I mean, if it's still going on, unless things are much, much, much different and things have been sort of resolved. I don't know that that's a possibility, but I like to think that I see him as the barometer, the measuring stick for this. Consistent, you know, listen, when you're an 80-year-old white guy who spent 20 years working in American government, you should rightly be booed off the stage at an Arcapulco, but he gets a standing ovation because he was the one guy that was consistent in his anti-war policies. And he was the one that wanted to end the Federal Reserve and he wanted personal liberty and all. He wanted us to be responsible for ourselves, right? It seems like in America, over the last, I don't know, generation or so, that's gone away, right? It seems that everyone wants the government to do something for them and right. They don't want to take care of themselves. And when you get into a place where you're outsourcing your critical thinking to the state, you're outsourcing your well-being, you're outsourcing your medical well-being to the state. Oh yeah. My God, guard, that puts you down a path towards, I mean, like at that point, like I don't want to hear any complaints. You know, right. you asked for this. Like you think the government gives a shit about your health? Like they want to milk you to as long as they can and then discard you, put you in a boxcar to be resettled in the East. And if you freeze to death standing up, they don't give a shit about that. They'll just find new people to replace you. They might even just walk them in the south, you know, the southern border, right? But that's a whole other issue in and of itself. But it seems that we've lost that intellectual consistency. The ideological consistency. Ron Paul brought it though. He's brought
it for a long
time. And I think that people that are unfamiliar, he's the last guy I voted for. He's the last guy I'll ever vote for.
I
don't think that, but we need a Ron Paul, right? Like, is there a Ron Paul in our farm system somewhere that's coming
Thomas
up?
Massey's pretty darn close, you know? But you know, Charlie, I'm curious. Did you ever, do you remember that book, The Myth of Sisyphus by Camus? You know, they called him an existentialist, but he was really an absurdist. And so, you know, he talks about Sisyphus and, you know, the mythological figure and how a lot of people say, oh man, that's such a curse. You know, Sisyphus has to keep rolling that rock to the top of the mountain only to see it rolling back down again. You know, the whole cipher to life and all that stuff. And a girl I really liked, I was just in love with this girl. She suggested I read it. So of course I read it. It's fairly short, you know, because I wouldn't have come close to Camus if she hadn't recommended reading a couple things by him, like The Stranger and The Plague and that. So I was like, okay, cool. And I was very impressed because in it, he explains, you know, he's like, look, and I like to go a little past that, actually. So he says, look, and you look at Ron Paul, he's been pushing that rock, right? So long. And what Camus said was, people don't realize that as you know, Sisyphus goes and pushes it up only to see it go back down again. He's not a slave all the time. There's a moment there when he's still free. And he says it's when he's going back down the mountain to go get the rock again. He's just walking. He says it depends on his attitude, whether or not he's going to enjoy that time, whether he's going to savor that freedom. Because we all have burdens, right? And some of these we take on ourselves voluntarily. And if you are taking it on voluntarily, try to keep that positive sentiment. Try to realize, I got into this because I think it's valuable. I might get frustrated. I might get down, but in the end, I'm doing what I think is important and valuable and good. And that's what I think is so great about Ron Paul, is he still brings that positivity. And what I think is cool is, you know, we can talk about these stories. Like you look at the amount of work pushing up that rock just to get a few more people in England to realize that the NHS is an evil thing. That they literally had the Liverpool, I've mentioned this a few times, the Liverpool end of life pathway. They used to call it the Liverpool protocol, where literally, and it's in the Obamacare thing and not so many words under best practices written by Ezekiel Emanuel, who doesn't want people to live past 75. So they've got the whole idea of, well, we only have a certain amount of common resources because, of course, the government's going to control it. So we have to pick and choose. Even though people were critical of insurance companies and, you know, forcing, you know, asking people to pay a little bit more if they were higher risk. Well, now the government in England, they withhold hydration and food, and they started at Liverpool Hospital for very sick, people near death who are elderly and very sick younger people, because they're not going to be productive. They're likely going to die. So they kill them. So they can free the bed and it's not expensive. In some hospitals in England, and this is a fact, they used the bodies of babies and burned them in the furnaces for heat.
Ugh.
I mean, they've got a Nazi healthcare system after World War II, 1947, they bring it in. And so we've got a massive burden just to get people. I used to go to England like twice a year, and I would tell people, like, are you aware? And be like, well, if we don't have it, what's going to happen? I'm like, are you aware of what's happening now? You're thieving from future generations. Isn't that bad enough? How about you just, if you have competitive markets, people are incentivized to bring you the stuff for less because somebody else is going to beat them to it. Do you understand? It's a simple mechanism. It's like lemonade stands on a street. They're going to try to drive the price down, not up. And if they do try to drive it up, there's an opportunity for somebody to enter the market and keep the price low. Or you can do it yourself. You've got an incentive. Change your profession. I can make a bunch of money now. That's the way the market works. Price signals are really important. And when government influences things, it screws up the price signals, whether it's for gaming the system, for rent seeking, for big corporations, or regulations that block energy from coming in, or land seizures out west where they don't allow drilling when they could allow drilling. I don't know what that land should be used for. Maybe it should be used for tourism. I don't know. It's not my land. Why do I have a say in it? Why don't I just shut the hell up and let those people live their lives? Why do I have a say at what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico for drilling? Why not establish private property rights there and find out how people value these things? Why don't we find out how much people value healthcare versus other things that might be important in their lives, right? No, we can't do that because it's public health. We can't allow this business to be open. We have to claim that your profession is non-essential. I mean, it's just the mindset of it is so egalitarian and elitist and completely foul. So we have this massive rock to push up the hill. But I would go past Camu in a couple of ways. First, we do have that freedom every time we come down. And that's why I embrace guys like you. You know, I say, these are my guys. You know, these are good guys. And that satisfaction carries me. That'll carry me through my whole life. You know, as I said, if I don't change anything, I found my family, you know, or whatever. Yeah. But by the same token, also in the pushing of the rock, I find satisfaction in the pushing of the rock. The pushing of the rock is not a curse for me anymore. No. I'll push it until the last breath, you know, because it's fine. You know, I'm pushing the freedom rock. It's cool. You know, I'm fine with that.
Well, the Adam Smith invisible hand of marketplaces, you know, when the government gets involved, it's like the invisible middle finger, you know. I mean, they change everything and they don't allow the markets to do their thing. You rig the Forex and the COMEX and LIBOR, and you rig all these marketplaces, and then you go, well, I'm just trying to get ahead. I'm trying to make it work. I can't understand why I keep getting beat out. But Well, you're getting beat out because the company that you're competing against has direct relationships with the government and they're tilting the scales in their favor. So of course you're going to lose. Okay. Of course you're going to, Bob's lumber store is going to shut down. Of course. Yeah. It has right. to. Right. If it's going up against a behemoth that has, that's paid the fare. They've donated money to the political campaigns and Citizens United. What do you think of Citizens United? Allowing corporations to. I might have wound you. Right
Jesus, you know, and again, so there are a couple things there. First, on the Citizens, I'll get to Citizens United in just a second, but you reminded me, you know, you talk about the trucking companies, right? Mm-hmm. So there are two things. One, there's and sort of we talked about this the other day, just off the show. But first, I'll get to the other one in a second. First, the Yellow Trucking Company just recently, I think they're based out of like Texas or something like that. I don't know. But one of the major trucking companies around, one of the guys who watches my show, a guy named MJ, super cool dude. He's a trucker. I want to get him on next week if I can, because they've got so many regulations about the number of hours that the truckers can be out there. And these have been going on for years, going back to the Clinton administration, even back to 1930s, they would establish, oh, you got to write down how long you're on there in the books. FDR, you know, it's like, geez, man. So they've, with COVID in particular, they just destroyed the trucking companies. And now there's another trucking company that because, and this is ridiculous, because people don't realize that immigration, the word immigration is not in the U.S. Constitution. It's supposed to be a state thing. On their playground of the U.S. Constitution, it was 1875 that there was a decision in the Supreme Court that basically invented the federal control over immigration. Naturalization is in the Constitution, not immigration. Texas had, when it entered the Union and it had its Constitution written, they put a Bureau of Immigration in their state constitution. It's right there. It's like, just, you know, nobody pays attention to this stuff. So now, because of the immigration stuff, this trucking company has to check the immigration status of anybody who comes to apply to be a trucker. Now, there's a space in the market because Yellow is going kapunked, right? They're going kaput. So there's more trucking companies might be able to enter the market if they can just maybe get a hold from this, you know, what's left of this system that Biden and Trump destroyed, right? But so this trucking company that I can't remember where they're based out of, they wanted to check the immigration status of those people, because if they don't, they can be fined by the federal government for hiring people who aren't legal to work. Now, that's a term right there, that if you've got a government saying, we got to check your work legality status, you might start thinking maybe they're wearing brown shirts and they're clicking their heels. Yep. They've got some Nazi insignias, because that's pretty nasty to tell your neighbor, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to check to see whether you can work. No, screw you. All right.
Right.
It's peaceful. Leave me alone. So they have to check. But because there were a certain number of Hispanic people who applied in certain numbers that represented more than 50% of the applicants, they've got this other thing that the feds apply, which is an inappropriate, what is it? I can't even remember the term. It's like an inappropriate effect on a certain minority group. So if it's more than a certain percentage, they think that you are checking, you are discriminating against a certain minority group, when in fact it's members of that particular minority group that represent the majority of the people who are coming in to ask for the jobs. They're right. In a catch 22. They can't win. They just got fined $700,000, and there was no trial, no Fourth Amendment. We have a warrant. Please give us your information. No Fifth Amendment. No speedy trial. No Sixth Amendment. No Eighth Amendment. They were punished without a trial. You know, Eighth Amendment prohibits unreasonable punishments, you know, cruel and unusual punishments, right? Well, right. How can you get punished if you haven't even had a trial? I guess maybe they'll just start drone striking people like they did, you know, Americans over in the Middle East, right? No, well, you know, total extrajudicial.
They should have paid more money to finance political campaigns then, right? Through Citizens United. If they had done that, then if they'd played game, if they'd played ball, then when it comes time to like look and, well, these people are violating this dumb rule that we've got. Like, do we go after them or not? Well, it would be bad to go after them because they donated to so-and-so's campaign and that guy sits on the committee that does this and this. And the next thing you know, I'm going to have to take a phone call from that guy and I don't want to do that. So let's just kind of let this go. So that is putting your thumb on the scale, is it
not? Big time. Yeah. Did you read that piece? It was from a little while ago by Lee Fang on his Substack. And it was about Nikki Haley and how she went from basically having $15,000 and like, you know, hundreds of thousand dollars in debt, but 15 grand in the bank to being like a multimillionaire and having this like giant estate in Florida and getting on the board of Lockheed Martin, I think it was. And all this stuff, you just sit there like, that's it. That's exactly it. It's the total Citizens United. But here's the thing, you know, how are they going to fix this, right? How are they going to fix it? They're going to fix it in a way that will lean towards what? Silencing speech and criticism of politicians running for office. I was in a room with John McCain in 1999.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I know. It was pretty bad. And I had written a quote down. I went back and found it. He was on Meet the Press in like 1997 or something. And he was pushing for so-called campaign finance reform, right? And it was the McCain-Feingold, I think it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Russ Feingold, I don't know. I think it was McCain-Feingold. And they wanted to make it, he wanted to have this portion of it that said that any citizen who was critical of a politician who was in office could be considered part, that criticism could be considered part of a campaign if they spent money, like to put an ad out or anything like that. That could be considered, or, you know, online, if they, you know, had a website, that could be considered part of a political campaign and could be shut down or fined by the feds. So I'm in the room. It's like 96 degrees in my town here. And my town is called Amherst, New Hampshire. That, by the way, is named after the colonial general or whatever, the British general, who was the guy who came up with the idea to try to give the Indians mats that were infested with disease-carrying lice.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, they didn't do it, but they say it's the first example of like biowarfare that somebody came up with. Right. And the town's named after the guy. I'm like, well, how appropriate that John McCain should be here, right? So right. I'm down there, I'm sweating, it's super hot. I get the first question out. I was like, Senator McCain, you said that to engage in political criticism of you could be considered part of a political campaign and could be silenced by the FEC. And he goes, I never said that. I was like, well, you said that on August 7th, 1997 on Meet the Press. I've written the quote down. He goes, oh, well, yes. I was like, dude, you're ready to lie to this entire friggin' room. Then later, we passed by each other. And at that time, that was when they were bombing Serbia. And Clinton had gone out. It was way past the War Powers Act. He was, you know, wiping people out. And I think if he goes there, they're going to arrest him or something like that. If he goes to Serbia, I think. So I passed by McCain. It's like, hey, I'll send you a ticket. It's Ron Brown special. Head on over, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Pay no attention.
Pull it in the back of the head.
Yeah, exactly. Pay no attention to that at signal by the sea. Just keep going. Yeah, you get the bullet in the back of your head. So so he passes by me and we just were sort of forced to like acknowledge each other, right? And he goes, we need more people like you with things like this. And I was like, you really think you want more people like me here? I was like, if we had more people like me here, there'd be fewer people like you here. And he's like, so he didn't like that, right? So yeah. Then I said, and by the way, even if you think the War Powers Act is constitutional, we're way past the War Powers Act, and they're still dropping bombs on Kosovo. He goes, oh, yes, we're very concerned about that, my friend. I'm like, okay, my friend, what are you going to do? Nothing. Didn't do a friggin' thing.
And our mutual friend, Tony Arterburn, was there watching the UN bomb Kosovo.
That I remember, and you were just talking about it just recently, or you brought it up. I know you brought it up recently in another pod. Yeah, he was there watching it happen. And good God bless Tony. What a good guy. You know,
one of the best people I've ever known.
Absolutely.
He's such a solid guy. To be in that and be anti-war and to watch what's going on and to see it from the inside, it's that
and to get out.
Been,
and to get out and
he got
intact
out.
And in better and better mentally than probably when you went in. I have a lot of respect for Tony Arterburn, a whole lot. And but that's what Empire does, right? If you just allow it to run unchecked, they'll lie right to your face. Tell you in a meeting with McCain, he'll try to lie to you or everybody in that auditorium, then covertly continue the bombings, totally illegal bombings done by NATO, and then go to the Rumsfeld when it gets caught. You know, when you get a couple years down the road, you just say, oh, you know, mistakes were made. You know, we don't want to live in the past. And, you know, and you go, no. Well, we've got time to live in the past on this one. Let's make sure that this doesn't happen again. And Guard, let's wrap up with this. Where are we headed? Right. So we're getting ready to start 2024, and it's going to be, you know, it's the most important election of our lifetime, in case you didn't notice. That's what they tell us every 4 years.
Yes, exactly.
And this one feels weird. I spoke at an event last night and I was talking to the audience. I was like, you know, like, how are you guys feeling? Are you feeling like very tense and like something weird is coming? And it was like a universal head nod. Like, yeah, it feels like we're being set up for something. And I don't have a crystal ball and I can speculate, I guess, but it feels like an election in the tail half of 2024. You know, there's going to be a lot leading up to that. What are your spidey senses telling you about, since we'll keep it sort of, in your wheelhouse of comic books? What are your spidey senses telling you about where we're going in 2024?
Well, yeah, boy. And I'm glad I really wish I could have seen you there in Colorado, man.
Oh, it was fun.
Been just awesome.
It's a great group. Liberty on the Rocks, Colorado, in Denver, man. It was a great group of people, man. I was like, these are my people right here. Yeah.
You know, quick aside, somebody, when I was doing my podcast around 2008, 2009, somebody wrote to me from Denver and they said, I went into the bathroom in a restaurant. Your podcast was playing over the speakers in the bathroom.
No way.
That's so cool. Yeah. I was like, that's really cool, man. That's awesome. I'd love to find out the place. I'll like send him a note. Thank you or whatever. But I do get that sense too. And I always check myself to say, so there are maybe three things that I would bring up here. One is I get that vibe too. The other is I think to myself, Charlie, I almost get a sense that the people behind the inner workings right now, that they're a little discombobulated too. They're trying to pull certain things. I think a lot of the stuff they're doing about Trump, I think a lot of people think that it's, you know, wrestling and that Trump is, you know, a cutout and that he's put up there. Trump was bad enough with his decisions on their own. And David Stockman's got a new book that even for people who thought that Trump's, you know, reduction in corporate taxes might have been okay, he says if you look at the overall record of Trump economically, it was abysmal. And I want to talk to him and find out if there's a separation between some of those. And again, he would never have gone far enough for me. But if there's a separation between the years of the COVID lockdown stuff and the PPP and the CARES Act and all that $2 trillion worth of crap that he supported putting out there, the Federal Reserve can now buy the bonds of any corporation they want without telling anybody. Oh, that's great. So I don't know whether Trump was a cutout or if he was just so egotistical and daft that, you know, he just let this sort of nonsense happen. You know, I don't know whether when Deborah Birx was literally standing next to him saying, oh yeah, we're paying people to fudge the numbers in hospitals about Cowabunga 19. You know, clearly he doesn't have any clue about the Constitution. He's not a pro-peace guy. Otherwise he would have stopped sitting on all the oil in Syria and stopped drone killing people. So all that stuff is out the window. But I get a sense, regardless of the battles about the Trump is going to be arrested. I sound like Bill Cosby. Regardless of the Trump with the bouncing about, I'm in jail. You know, regardless of that Trump stuff, when it comes to things like the sentiment we're starting to hear on the pushback against Israel's attack on the Palestinians. And even there, people are starting to separate from the talk radio host. They're saying, wait, why are you continuing to push the Zionist, you know, statist line here? They're starting to see the difference between the state and the people. That's what I've noticed during this extremely hot time of war. The people and the state, people are starting to recognize the plight of the people. So that's kind of cool. And the question for me is, it's like a race. They're racing as quickly as they can to get speech controls and energy controls and travel controls and as much information as they can with excuses about climate and diseases. So I honestly don't know whether there might be a couple things that pop up. Somebody inside the inner working puppet string pullers, you know, and there are various groups of these, might do something very, very reckless, thinking that they've got stuff set and ready to go. And I don't know. Or we might just slide through this and be caught in the economic malaise. Thank you, Jimmy Carter. I'll put my sweater on. Malaise of the Fed destroying the buying power of the dollar. Some more people going to crypto. Liz Warren trying to stop crypto for a few more years. I don't know. It's really, really tricky for me to see. I just hope that they don't pull some terrible thing because they think that they can control the speech, they can control the internet, they can control travel because they've tested it under Cowabunga 19.
Yeah.
So that's, and then the rest of it for me is just trying to sound the alarm, get the warning out, feel comfortable in what I'm doing and that happiness that I get to feel and saying, yeah, you know, I'm pushing that rock. I honestly, it is a very confusing time. And I just don't know. I'm not sure, but I do sense that there's some desperation on the part of these people who are trying to game their system. They might pull back and they might still have a comfort zone where they can pull back from some of their stuff, recalculate, and then push forward with some new thing a few years from now. Maybe they've tested, they found the film of the bubble. And they say, okay, we're going to pull back now. We've seen what's happened with that. Let's try this other vector that we're setting up. Yeah. I just don't know, you know, and I don't want to sound like, you know, really disappointing on that sort of a field for folks. Because I'd like to give them hope. As that song Skydiver by Stum, I was listening to that. I got to have some hope. I have to have some hope or I'll jump right off the face of it. Yeah, good song by Stum. Skydiver.
I have hope. Not because I think the government is coming to save us, but I feel like they have overplayed their hand in so many components of this and they've woken up a lot of people to what's going on. I think whether it was JFK or 9/11 or COVID, these big major events, they shake a certain percentage of the population awake and they go, what you're telling me is nonsense. A single gunman and Kennedy or whatever, 19 Arab hijackers whose passports magically didn't you know, catch on fire, or a virus that's so dangerous that everybody's going to die. You know, where are the stacked up bodies on the sidewalk? We didn't see any of that. And so the messaging has been disjointed. And I feel like there's a certain segment of the population that just goes, yeah, but you guys are lying. And this, right. even for the normies out there, it kind of breaks them open and it starts them down that path. And for me, it was 9/11, and that eventually leads you, if that's a lie, what else is a lie, right? And so for the new batch of people, they're going to say, well, if COVID was a lie, what else is a lie? You know, and then that starts them down that path. So I'm hopeful in that regard because I know it's woken up a huge component, but just as many of those people that are awake, I don't know the numbers, but there's also another component that is dug in even further and is now even more terrified of the big bad world out there, and they want daddy government to come in and save them and protect them, and they'll do whatever they want. Tell me what to do, just make it all stop, just make it stop, and I'll comply. You want me to live in a 15-minute city? You're going to give me a universal basic income. I need that. Just, what do you need me to do? You need me to not say these nasty things online. You need me to sign up for the Pfizer's injection membership. Whatever you want me to do, just make it stop. And so it's going to be an interesting, it's going to be an interesting year. I'm not trying to, I don't know that it'll be a good one. I don't know that it'll be a bad one. I just know that we're going to see things that we never expected. Our bingo card for 2024 is definitely going to be different than our bingo card for 2023. There's always going to be, you know, the random Chinese spy balloon that nobody sees coming. They go, I didn't have that on my card, you know? So I guess get ready for the show, right? Keep your ticket.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as Joey says, keep your ticket. We're going to do another.
Exactly. Show. Keep your ticket. We're coming back. And And I think also, you know, every day, every week there's a story. There are a couple major things. There's always something that needs, in my view, requires my attention. I've got to get the information out there, get that information out, keep fighting. And then I try to mix it with deriving some, you know, historical lessons from these things that people can carry away with them. That satisfaction watching Ron Paul or Daniel McAdams was talking with Angry Tiger the other night or last night. It was great. So it's a mixture for me. And then, because there are all these stories, and I think a lot of people, I think a lot of people trick themselves or they fool themselves into thinking, oh, I'm getting so exhausted by this news. I'm getting so down by this news. No, you're cool. You got the power. Keep rocking it. You know, you got the energy. You got the resentment. You've got that drive. You got the positivity. And that's what I think the other thing is, every once in a while, if people are feeling this, you know, okay, we've got, what's going to happen with Zelensky? Is he going to leave? What's going to happen with Russia? Is NATO going to, you know, are they going to partition that place? Is NATO going to turn that into the new Israel, have a new wall there? What's going to happen with Gaza? What about the lockdowns? What about the economy? You know, is it going to be Biden again, you know, slamming us with this? What about speech controls? What about, you know, digital currency? All these different types of questions. So many things pop up, right? But every once in a while, if people are getting stressed out, I would say one of the things that I like that gives me great, it's like a breath of fresh air. And in a way, Charlie, and I don't want to make this sound like, buttering up or fandom or anything like that. But every once in a while, you know, my parents aren't around, you know, and so I used to get this wonderful sort of soul refreshing opportunity of, it was like a drink of cool water when you're getting, you know, really intense about stuff, when you need that extra sucker, it turned to guys like you. And if we can talk to each other, right, it's really cool. And in a way, it's because I feel like I'm talking with a guy who's got more wisdom than I have. And
likewise, you've read the books I haven't even heard of.
I'm going to make up sometime, like, yeah, you know, it'd be like Star Trek with Thisbin. I always talk about, like, oh, that's a cronk. You got yourself a cronk there. I'll make it, you know, a book by Joe Cronk or something like that. Right. But it is interesting. And maybe it's just a part of the human psyche or something like that. But, you know, when I feel like I'm going to be watching you or James Corbett or whatever, and now getting to talk to you, it is really like having that time to get that sort of comforting reassurance of, and this is what I emailed you last night when I saw this conversation with Daniel McAdams, and I thought about that positive, and it's really nice. It is. It's like getting lunch on a busy day. Like, well, that was really great, you know? And I appreciate that so much. It's a nice, fun, upbeat sort of thing. It's great. It's really good stuff for me, big time.
Well, I appreciate talking to you and getting to know you. And look, we don't have it all figured out. Of course, we're working on it. But I think it's about perspective too. Could always be worse. You could be walking from the Soviet Union to India, right?
Yeah. So, oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah, it's wild, you know. And one last thing, Charlie, you know, it's weird because you see these stories. Like, you know, I worked in fiction, and I mentioned this to David Knight, where when I was a kid, I used to watch TV and I would see the stuff on the screen. And there was always this disconnect between the fantasy, the fiction, the stories. I love the stories. Star Trek, you know, it's not real, but it's kind of real in its own way, right? It's this weird sort of thing. And then you go to work in the studios, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but one time I used to go at the towards the end of the day, I would go visit my friend Mick's place. Mick had a dog and he couldn't be there. He would leave the TV on for the dog. And I would go let the dog out to, you know, go to the bathroom and that sort of thing. And she was super, super nice. And when I would get there, old reruns of Bonanza would be on. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I mentioned this to David Knight too. And at the time, they were the black and white episodes at that time that I realized, I was like, I was mostly on set. They didn't have the budget at that time. It was just on set with backdrops and stuff. I was like, I think I just got this vibe that that was the Paramount lot. I was like, that, I bet that was Paramount. I don't know why I'm thinking that, but I think it was Paramount. So I stayed to the end. And sure enough, they shot it on Paramount, probably in the same soundstage I was on for Voyager, right? Walking on the same concrete, right? Yeah. And it gets you, as you get older, you see stuff, you realize they're just workaday people. Somebody invested the money to get the land to let people do this as opposed to making widgets or, you know, having a lumber yard or whatever. Different generations go in, they try to do their work, raise their families. And so now I've moved from creating fiction for escapism and television for escapism to realizing I'm connecting with people. And those stories that you bring up about, you know, the long walk, it's a weird thing because those guys are long gone. And if you think about it too hard, sometimes it can get so stressful and so depressing and so sad. These are real stories. This is a real guy who survived this. I'm not able to talk to him. And yet it's weird. Like you get this satisfaction about reading about this story. And we mention the titles of these books, these real people and so on. And sometimes it becomes really abstract. I saw Andrea Bocelli last night. I wondered whether or not he and his family, his beautiful family, and all these people in the audience, how many of them are suffering now because of these people and the ideas that people accept. And that gets me back to that positive where I can say, I'm just going to try to tell people, hey, let's fight against those ideas and the people who try to use them. Well, they won't be able to use them anymore. So it just consistently just keep going as the stories pop up, find those historical nuggets and connect with entertainment in a different way now and realize their lessons. And then the real entertainers, the today people like you, you know, bringing out that positive vibe. I love that. It's great. You give the update news in this really positive way. Like now, when I think about you, I think about an Acapulco. I see sunshine. It's the weirdest thing. Yeah, it's so cool. Every time I see you, I see your smile. I'm like, wow, that's cool, man.
I jokingly say that I aspire to one day just be doing a football podcast, because then it means that the problems that we're facing have been sorted out and that they're all gone and that it's not a priority anymore. We're in better shape. And so if you catch me in the future and macroaggressions is gone and it's the football equivalent of it, just know that that's a great sign, and hopefully we can get there. And hopefully we can talk our way out of jobs doing what we do. Speaking of that, Gard, where's the best place for people to find you and support your work?
Sure. Probably the best thing to do is first just follow the Twitter X feed. It's at Gard, G-A-R-D Goldsmith. Then I've got Substack. That's Gardner Goldsmith Substack, and it's G-A-R-D-N-E-R Goldsmith. And then my fiction is on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I've got some novels that I declined a contract one time because they wanted me to change my name. So my political stuff was like, nah, I'm just me. Like, screw you. So that book hasn't come out yet. I'll probably have to put it out myself. So, but Amazon, just look up Gardner Goldsmith. I have a story that's in one book. It's called Chiral Mad, if you want to get it. And it's about a pandemic. I wrote it like 8 years before the pandemic. It's got the 6 foot distancing and shutting down of businesses. It's all in there. And
somebody read your book.
Yeah, exactly. I got the idea. Some guy from the CIA said, you ought to write a story. No. But it's brought to you by Pfizer. Substack X/ Twitter, Gard Goldsmith. And then every Monday through Friday on Rumble. And on Rockfin, and this is the one I really should be concentrating on most to expand and get people to check it out. Please visit the Liberty Conspiracy. It's just Liberty Conspiracy or Liberty Conspiracy Live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Just check us out, Rumble and Rockfin, and it'd be great to see you there.
That's Gard Goldsmith, everybody. He's just the absolute best. If you want to follow his work and support him, please do. If you want to connect with me, the website is The Octopus of Global Control. I'll catch you all later. Take care.